if I just stuck doing my one little micro thing, I don't know. I don't like to sit on my hands. Some people can afford to and do that, and it's just not my way. I want to, like I said, want to be busy. I want to take on challenges. I want to challenge myself. I want to challenge others. And, you know, I'm here to work. I'm not here to sit and not try to get to the next level.
You know, a lot of times when I interview guests, they kind of have, you know, it's just like, not in a bad way, just they did one thing and they just did it a long period of time. I feel like you've already in a, you know, in a short period of time, pivoted multiple times. And really the lesson, you know, for the audience is you kind of have this like vision for your life, this track, and this is what I'm going to do. And life doesn't always cooperate, right? The market doesn't always cooperate. And you just naturally had ability, developed the ability to just like shift quick and just stay malleable and just stay moving forward. And I think that's to be admired. And obviously it's led you to tremendous success. So congratulations. Welcome to the Matthews Mentality Podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to be at ICSE. It's a real estate conference for those who don't know. We're at the New York show. They also have a big one in Vegas with David Shorenstein, a seasoned real estate professional and principal at Hildreth Advisors. Based in New York City, David brings over 15 years of experience in real estate investing, brokerage, and asset management. His journey into real estate began after earning a degree in finance from NYU Stern School of Business. That's a great school. I'm going to ask you some questions about that.
Sure.
Where he discovered his passion for tangible assets and pivoted from traditional finance to real estate. Before leading Hildreth Advisors, David co-founded Silver Shore Properties in 2010, where he successfully assembled and exited a New York City real estate portfolio valued at over $300 million across 250 properties. I might need to borrow some money, David. Additionally, he spent over 13 years running his own real estate business in the greater New York City area. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
What are you doing day to day right now? Like, I know you got your hands in a lot of things. What's keeping you busy?
You know, always blocking and tackling.
So you play football?
All right, I did play football. It's my favorite thing in the world. Football. I mean, I wish football and real estate have a lot of similarities.
They you do. Know, yeah. You put your head, you know, into something like against the wall long enough and eventually it falls, right?
That's right. So that's why, you know, if I'm good at real estate, just keep knocking, you know,
small
defensive lineman. I was a small offensive lineman and just kept getting the crap beaten out of me, you know,
but you
every
just kept
single
coming.
Day. And then eventually you make a tackle, right? And then you get a little more playing time and you
that's New York real estate, right?
And you make a block that's a semi chop block and you keep going and your running back scores.
It's only a penalty if they throw a flag.
That's right.
No, but so day to day, what are you doing now?
Day-to-day, working on current portfolio, working on a lot of land entitlements.
What does current portfolio look like?
I have a New York City portfolio of only free market buildings in Manhattan.
Define free market for the non-New York real estate investor.
5 units and under.
Okay.
That's the way I would characterize it. Anything that's not 5 units and under could have gray area, which I don't play in the gray area.
Sure.
So I have a nice jewel box portfolio of 5 unit and under with retail, all with retail, restaurants and or
ground floor
retail.
Okay.
So I have that portfolio. Then I have a master portfolio of multi-tenant strip centers.
In the tri-state region?
Tri-state region.
Okay.
So we have a number of those, about 17 of those property. Yeah. You know, all value add. I like to buy from long-term owners only. So these are, everything has a story to it of when I bought
it. Yeah, long-term owners often, you know, again, I'm generalizing, not necessarily good for you, but like maybe a little mismanaged or just not aggressively managed, if I may.
Correct. Yeah. All mismanaged. I'm closing on one next week. That is about 40% empty. A lot of people overlooked it.
Especially in the retail market, for those who don't know, because you have a pretty wide audience now and a lot of Martin real estate, let alone retail. Retail's having its moment in the sun, especially strips and shadows. Like retailers on average are doing very well. So to be 40% vacant, that generally, me just knowing about this now, would speak to just a lack of management.
Lack of management. I mean, they didn't even have a for rent sign on the vacant spaces. So that shows.
As having worked with a lot of buyers, those are the deals you want to buy.
Yes. And they're very few and far between. I always say to myself, I wish I had 10 of these, then I'd be further along.
Well, you got 17.
17, you know, I tried to exit them because when you have investors, you have to try to make your promote. So in these, you know, there's a big range. These are from $2 million up to, let's call it $15 million strip centers. Mm-hmm. So I'm always trying to grow that portfolio. Like I said, these things are very few and far between. They also don't come to market very often, and people want low caps for them, below usually what the interest rates are. You know, that's just what sellers want, because these things produce cash. Why would someone sell them unless they're at that point of the retirement, or mm-hmm. they don't want to deal with it or chase their tenants for the money? And usually that's when they've owned it 20 plus years.
So you have the five units in Sonoma, you have the multi-tenant strip. Any other?
I also am in the middle of building a car wash roll up. So we just signed a contract for our fourth car wash. We bought and sold one before. So I've been working on that, and it's still a very hot space. That's where investors, I think, want to invest.
A lot of PE money.
That we're looking towards the exit. Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked to a bunch of the PE firms, and we're under this has always been my issue of being under the dollar amount that PE firms want to put out. So if I'm buying something for $5 million, $10 million, PE firms want to put out. I was with a guy yesterday. He says, no, minimum check size is $200 million. And this, and he's my personal investor. So if I was going to bring it to his company,
it's a big one.
He's got to put in, if he gives me $250,000, he wants to put out $200 million if it was his company. Jeez. So it's like, I'm like, I guess I'll just sell it all to you. So yeah. They want to make their fees, and it's understandable. So I have that platform. And we also buy marinas. We own a large marina out in Montauk, and we're trying to grow that. Also, these things, car washes, laundromats, marinas, which I started getting into 2 years ago when real estate became very slow. You know, I buy them in places where they can't ever be built again or recreated. So there's always someone that's willing to pay more, I think. And
that's a big driver, is like supply constrained, like almost, you know, impossible barrier of entry type of deal.
Impossible barrier of entry. So, you know, my plan with these esoteric businesses, marina, laundromat, car wash, build these portfolios, which I've done before. And then at the right time, you know, we'll look to exit, but now is probably not the right time.
How'd you get into real estate?
It's a very good story. So,
well, we're here to tell stories. So
we're here
story.
To tell stories. Yeah. So I was 22, graduating from NYU, looking for finance jobs. Didn't really grasp the idea of finance.
You're looking to be a man in finance?
A man in finance, you know, like a man, like a...
Did you get that, Zach?
You know, I could have worked at a bank, maybe, and been a relationship manager, something like that. Because my skill set was more people person. Mm-hmm. So I took one real estate course at NYU, fell in love with the material, not necessarily the numbers and the Excel, wasn't very good at Excel, very good at reading Excel, not making Excel. And then just started trying to make connections with people, something I do to this day. Someone introduced me to a guy, high-level broker in the city, introduced me to this family that owned real estate, or a real estate company, owned office buildings. And I was hired making $25,000 a year. It was my first job.
Ballin'.
Yep, ballin'. And 10% commission split. So 90 to the house, 10 for me on office leases. And these office leases were not...
I need to switch... This Matthews to that deal.
That's okay, but I could tell you what happened to them later.
Oh, like, no, no,
okay.
Never mind.
Okay. So, you know, it's called a little bit of karma. But yeah. After a month of that job, I was fired because I was too entrepreneurial and I was trying to put together building sales deals, because there was one old guy in the office who would just, he would be selling buildings. He'd have the Massey Knackle books there, $100 million. And that's like, it's like, wow, there's money in building sales. So let me see if I can find setups from Massey or Besson. And that's how I taught myself about building sales, looking at those setups. And you would just download the PDFs online, similar to today, I guess. And then I would just start sending them to my friends that were rich, you know, like, or their families are in real estate. I never made a deal that way. I mean, I learned later the right way to do things.
But that's why you got fired.
That's why I got fired. Exactly. They said they didn't want brokers. They wanted someone to relocate bad office tenants, they're bad office buildings. That was the job.
Sounds sexy.
Yeah, sounds sexy.
Yeah. Desirable. Probably grew up dreaming of doing
and, that. And, you know, walking from 8 blocks over into the garment center, which was not what it is today. this area. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say this area. You know, there's no Hudson Yards.
Yeah, it changed a lot, especially with Hudson Yards.
Yeah, there was nothing nice, right? So you're walking from like eight blocks and you have to wear a suit, hot, uncomfortable shoes, trying to take office tenants from one building and move it into their building. This before also security and things like that. So
it wasn't for you.
Ultimately, it wasn't for me.
And they told you that.
They told me that. They showed me the door.
What goes through your head when you get fired? Like, do you call your parents and like, you're never going to believe this? I mean, what?
Oh, of course. Because my parents, I grew up with no money. I grew up in a rent-stabilized apartment. And, you know, I had debt when I left college. I had credit card debt. I had student loan debt, six-figure student loan debt. And, you know, it was my grandfather was still alive at the time. You know, he said, you know what? I believe in you. I'll pay your rent for like 6 months because I didn't live at home at that time. I lived in the dorms throughout college. My mom scraped and saved so I didn't have to live at home. And then I went on, I don't know if I was crying.
Listen, you know, we're in a new day and age. Men can cry. I don't know if you got the memo. It's okay. Do we have tissues? Listen, no judgment from most people. I would judge you, but no, I'm just joking.
The idea was, there was a company, City Habitats, which is a big company. I was like, oh, maybe I'll rent apartments on the weekends while I find a new commercial job, building sales, office leasing, something like that. Because I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I go on Hot Jobs and they had a posting for like a commercial brokerage at City Habitats. So I was like, oh, maybe I could do both at the same place, create my own thing. So I go there, the guy hires me. And then ultimately ended up selling four buildings in a year. Calling out of the blue book. There was no Property Shark back then. Calling out of the blue book. I was put on a couple deals through the company because I was just aggressive. I didn't know what I was doing. That company, City Habitats, got sold to Corcoran and then went to Marcus Millichap. Myself and the guy I was working with at the time.
Oh, I didn't know you went to M&M. How long were you at M&M?
About 3.5 years.
Cool. How'd that go?
That was a great experience. I mean, that really taught me the way of how to canvas properly,
sure.
Research owner, how to value things.
What was your product focus?
It was just New York City, you know, mixed use, multifamily.
Like kind of a block by block system type deal?
Yeah, I mean, that would just, but it would lead me to other areas, you know, and it wasn't as, M&M was just also starting out right at that time, like 2007. It was existed for a few years in Manhattan.
Mitch LaBarre still there?
Yes, Mitch was the, and then he left shortly thereafter.
Yeah, and he came and managed me.
He's the best.
That's my guy. The best.
So that really taught us.
I love Mitch. Mitch, if you're listening, I love you, dog.
Yeah, what a great guy. So taught us.
That taught you, was there an agent or a team that you worked under?
We just were our own. Like we were kind of like, you know, we didn't go through the training, right? They didn't make us go through the training because they thought we had all this experience, sold four buildings.
Little did they know.
Right. My partner was 10 years older than me. He had some gray hair at 32, 33.
They probably thought, we just pulled this big recruiting win.
Right. They were like, this team is great. You know, like this team, we brought in people. Another guy who came with us is now at works for Glenn Konofsky.
Yeah, Glenn's awesome.
You know, he works with Glenn.
Stud, yeah.
You know, those are the... you know, those are the days. You know, those Marcus, it was a good run.
Yeah.
It was a good run.
What ultimately led you to decide to, you know, to leave or do something different?
I would say about 2006, 2007, you know, kind of forced out. You know, you get these things that are outside of your control almost, where they just...
GFC?
Yep. Okay. I would say the GFC. Well, then I was like, said to my partner at the time, I was like, you know, you're 34, 35. You want to build some equity for yourself instead of brokering all these deals. We were doing well. We sold an $82 million office building there. We had some big wins.
So you always had an angle going back to the NYU days of like tangible assets, passive income to a degree.
If that exists.
I was about to say like,
that's a misnomer.
And you know that there's actually no such thing.
Right.
Maybe in the net lease space, but that's a whole different
conversation.
Animal. Yeah. So, but hey, I'm going to have passive income. I want to get the ownership. That's what you mean by equity.
Building equity.
Okay.
Right. I know, obviously reading books, read a lot of books. You know, how to build your equity. You have to have assets, right? You have to amass assets. Mm-hmm. Why are we not to put down brokers, but I thought I could do both. And that's what I did at Marcus. There was a different manager. He let us buy some buildings.
Talking about JD?
JD was the sales manager. Oh. It was Ed Jordan.
Oh, I don't know Ed. I know JD.
He's out in Connecticut now, this guy Ed. I actually see him once in a while.
So he said
he let us do carte blanche. You know, if you're doing well in brokerage, you can buy these buildings here and there. And then
there's no law against that. There are laws about disclosure, but it certainly, it creates conflicts for sure. It
creates conflicts, especially when the clients. sponsor or whatever.
Yeah, for sure.
So it was really his family's money, my partner's family's money. There was no really syndicated capital, which was a mistake, or we just didn't know how to do it at the time. So we bought these buildings. GFC comes. He says, I'm not buying any more buildings. The brokerage business takes a dive. He doesn't want to buy anymore because he's concerned about preserving capital. Basically, get bought out, split, and then really started the next iteration with someone else. So it's another thing where, you know, you think things are going, never going to recover, right?
Yeah.
It's similar to what's kind of in the high interest rate environment, right?
Yeah,
it's
like, certainly it's on the brokerage side, it's been, man, half my job over the last couple of years is just, especially with the younger age, because they're not cycle tested. They've never been through it. And like COVID was so quick that really, if you've been in the business, I was just talking to someone about this other day, it's real estate specific. If you've been in the brokerage business going all the way back to really 2010, I mean, even 2009 was the bottom, but you never saw a drop. You only saw it get better from 2009 to 22. You could be in the business 10 years, you know, making $1 million, $2 million, and you've never actually seen a cycle. And then this one hits, which is driven by cost of capital, and they have no idea like what to do. They don't know what's going on. They're freaking out. They're panicking. And you know, at this company, like we got younger guys and gals, we have a lot of them, and you know, they've never seen it. And it's just getting like, hey, relax. It's tough. I get it. Let me tell you about my experience. Let me tell you what I did. And, you know, hopefully there's some lessons in there. But I can tell you, like, if history is a guidebook for us, it's going to pass at some point. And this will be the best thing that ever happened to you if, number one, you don't quit, right? And number two, you just keep doing the fundamentals. Like, you'll look back and be like, wow, like, that market taught me so much. It accelerates your skills, your development, and it wipes out a lot of the competitors, so...
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I do not know what a lot of people have been doing the last few years.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, well, you know, the people that just buy this or just buy that, and that's when...
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, it's nationally, it's slowed. I think velocity decline in 23 from 22, 55, 60%, which is a big one. I think New York is a different animal in the sense it's more than that. And I think a lot of what's driven that, first of all, get hit by COVID harder than anywhere. So yet go further back in time. So even in the zero interest rate environment of like post-COVID, like late 20, 2021, it was a good year, but like there was just so much fear in this market, rightfully so, because of what had happened in 2020. And then starting going back in, you know, really 2014, 15, you just the regulatory environment here, especially as it relates to multifamily, has really been a challenge for you guys, right?
Well, that's when I started that business in 2008. And it was out of that business by 2018.
Mm.
So another
pivot.
Another pivot,
yeah.
Right? And that's what I think has made me successful. And people tell me that. I don't think of it in my own mind. But able to pivot, able to think of new ideas, develop new talent. You know, I'm always trying to develop new talent with a young group of people. But it's tough to keep them motivated because everyone wants instant gratification. And this is a, you know, this thing takes...
You don't say.
You don't say. And then I look at some other things saying it really takes 10 years to build something. So right now I'm in year of my new business. I'm in year 6, right? And I'm just starting to see some like big benefits. Like I started over in 2019. Most people don't realize that. You know, they think I had this huge successful company, but it had to be disbanded because of things outside of my control. Regulatory environment, that was part of it. And you know, the sentiment towards New York.
Yeah.
And then COVID. I mean, whatever and was COVID. Left by then, forget it.
All right. So 2019, you unwind ultimately successful business. But let me go back a couple steps, whether it's, you know, when you're a broker or launching ultimately what became that business. Like what was your just, you know, from a tactics perspective, what was like the average day like? Were you burning the candles at both end, living that New York, like, you know, work hard, play hard environment? Were you... You know, were you balanced?
I mean, starting it off, I mean, I was in the Bronx on the weekends, you know, and that's what I don't see as much anymore. People really putting in that effort, that day to day. I know my business partner does it, and that's why we're partners, right? It's the work ethic, right? I don't.
When you say you're in the Bronx on the weekends, that was work related. Looking at buildings.
Oh yeah. Meeting sellers, climbing in windows. Yeah. I mean, I don't do that as much anymore, right? I have family or whatnot. But I'm still making it. Whoever I can call on the weekend, I'm calling them if it's prudent, right? If it makes sense.
Did that ever cross your mind when you were younger and really building a career and, you know, sacrificing ultimately a lot of time? Did I ever say, hey, like, why am I putting so much into this? Is it going to be worth it? Should I, you know, should I work less and focus on other hobbies or?
I mean, I always took time for myself. I don't know. I just, I also didn't necessarily have the money to go do some of the things that other people.
That's what I was going to ask, like, when you were getting into the business world, brokerage, principal, whatever, is it, what was your primary driver at that time?
Oh, I mean, I always pretend like I'm broke. That's just my mentality.
I like to spin it into saying it's financial independence.
Yeah, you know? Financial independence.
Right. So money, like just saying, hey, I gotta pay bills. That was the driver primarily.
Pay bills, but you know, not spend everything that you make. Obviously,
create wealth.
You know, create wealth. You know, invest it. But I would say it's just the hustling mentality.
I've noticed with a lot of people in your chair. I don't want to say suffer because there's a benefit, but like they experience what I call, this might be a clinical term, I don't know, financial anxiety, like where they're just to a different level than it appears most, like especially early in their career, like there's this kind of manic approach to their career, all in every hour of every day. And when I say like, what was driving you, it was just like, you know, I had to make money and then I wanted to create wealth and I always felt like I was broke. Is that a fair way to describe you, maybe even going back when you were younger? Is that something that you were raised to feel? Is that something you inherit as part of like a genetic trait? Like, I'm always so curious to know where this comes from.
Challenges growing up, you know, having money, losing money, you know, going through that at a young age, saying that's not going to happen to me again type of thing, but always feeling that it could happen again.
What was that thing, if you don't mind I ask, like what thing, or, you know, one or two things happened as a kid that really, it sounds like, imprinted on you?
Well, when you see your parents go through these struggles, right? And
what'd your parents do?
My mom was a recruiter, but then LinkedIn wiped out that business. You know, later on, after she did well enough to put my brother, who's also very successful, through college, right? Mm-hmm. That was the most important thing. And my father, you know, was in this business and that business and this business and that business.
I think they call those entrepreneurs.
Yeah, entrepreneurs. Yeah. But you know what? For me, same thing. Deals don't work out. I'm just more asset backed, mm-hmm. right? Like, so the deals I do, everything is backed by a business and asset. So there's something there. Like, you're not going to necessarily lose it all. You could, and it's happened. Don't get me wrong. Like,
it tends to less have, you know, kind of crazy swings, it seems like.
Less crazy swings, unless you're doing development, which I've done, some good, some bad. I'm indifferent.
Definitely in development.
Right. Right. So he wasn't a real estate developer, but you're in this business, you're in that business. And
there were periods of your childhood that it got thin. It got.
Oh, when you have to leave private school, you're the only one in this school and you have to find a new school. How was that?
Was that like your parents sit you down and say, hey, David, we're pulling you out of the school?
Yep. And it was just like a bomb goes off.
Yeah.
And you don't know
what's next.
Especially
as a kid, because that's your world.
Yep. And it's your friends, you know, and then you see who really cares about you, which at the end of the day is nobody. You know what I mean? Like, you just...
You'd almost like the Greek... It's from Greek society, I think, in Latin, where like ostracize is... To be ostracized 2,000 years ago is really, really bad. But feeling ostracized, like where you're like... Did you almost feel like... I don't want to say shame, like... The kids are like, oh, I'm the poor kid now. I can't afford to go.
Well, you don't even hear from them. So it's like you're there one day and you're gone the next, right? Mm. Like you find out who your friends are, which, you know, it's just you develop whoever is your true friend and you find out who your real friends are.
You're very driven. You've accomplished a lot. Do you think that's a big driver for you, is kind of like this showing them?
It's not necessarily about showing them. you know, and they don't care, right? They grew up with money. Some of them grew up with money and end up doing absolutely nothing with their lives. I don't think there's a correlation, but I just want to show myself. Like, it's for myself. It's for peace of mind. Like, I'm not necessarily always doing it for the money. It's for the success, for the challenge, you know.
Were you looking back as a kid, were you always like kind of a hustler driven, saying, I'm going to, like, if I asked your fifth grade teacher, hey, would David have done what, you know, accomplished, what would they say? Oh yeah, absolutely. It was always in it. We saw it from that, you know, when he was
absolutely not.
No, yeah.
Absolutely not.
What was it? Was it a moment or a period of time where you feel like that kind of switch got flipped on?
I think after college, when you're, you know, your insulated bubble, you know, you're living somewhere, you don't have to necessarily pay for it yourself, even though I'm going to debt for it, but not really understanding.
It doesn't feel the same.
Yeah, it doesn't feel the same. At that point, either light switch turns on or the light switch is never going to turn on.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen this with so many, I've worked with 100, 200 either interns mm-hmm. or young people, and some go on to start great things and do companies, which are very, very small percentage. And most end up, don't know what happens to them.
Yeah,
I
see it.
Yeah, you see it.
We see it. We've seen it. And yeah, you need that switch to have gone off. And sometimes I'm always fascinated in nature versus nurture. And for you, it seems like there certainly was a nurture component of seeing, you know, your parents and having your parents, seeing them, you know, kind of go through peaks and valleys professionally and then coming to you and pulling you out of the world you knew and all of that. And, you know, as you said, a bomb going off.
Yeah, because I've had a number of bombs go off, and that's why I'm able to, after the bomb, I'm not necessarily saying it's easy and you don't sleep, right?
Yeah.
Many sleepless nights.
But it seems like you, through those experiences, you've learned to, you know, be malleable, pivot, and also, you know, from a defensive back in football, you got to have a short memory. You know, you got like, 41 seconds between plays. Like, that's how long you have to ruminate and feel sorry for yourself and then on to the next play.
Yep.
But, you know, talk to me about the business you built after you left brokerage that ultimately, it sounds like, you feel like was really impacted negatively based on the increasing reach of the local government in terms of your ability to be a housing provider. Like, how was that?
Well, really, the pinnacle of the New York City real estate market, and other people have talked about it, was 2015.
Yeah.
So it was cuts by 1,000 deaths.
Death
by 1,000 cuts. Exactly. Yeah. I've never used that before. But yeah. So it was just it's one thing after the next. A little nick here, a little nick there. You can't do this. You can't do that. The things they're used to doing, right? And they put more scrutiny on everything else. And by the time it was 2017, and the plan was to sell stuff in bunches, which we did before, private equity to packages to Related and others, there were no buyers.
Mm.
By the time 2017 and we gave this package to someone, the bids were like 50% of what the value of like the broker.
There was
evaluation.
Too much regulatory uncertainty is what they call it.
Right. So there were a couple of, I wouldn't call them dumb buyers, but like people were willing to take risk, maybe buy things at a discount. So ultimately we did sell chunks here and there, the free market stuff.
And what was the product? Multi?
Yeah, mixed use, multi. Okay, some had 5 units and under, which were true free market, and those sold very quickly. Those people still always want, right? The 5 unit and under mixed use, fly off the shelf, right?
So 5 units and under is not subject to New York's?
No matter what.
Okay.
So then stuff that's over, which we had still had good paperwork. People didn't really, some people wanted to touch it. Some people were already out of it. People already started looking in other places, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were the typical usual suspects. So the buyer pool was very small, and getting rid of it was extremely difficult.
Hmm.
So that took years. That took years.
But you had an exit, right? How did that stack up with your expectations? And I don't just mean like in terms of pricing, just in like satisfaction feeling like, man, I put a lot of effort. Was it worth it?
That part was worth it, but the other part of it that did not exit, you know, you have to say to yourself, other people have gotten hurt on things and it can happen to you. No one's invincible, which maybe in 2014, 15, I was invincible, but 2018, 2019, I was vulnerable. And that's when I said, I got to start something else, right? And start building something, which, like I said, now I'm in year 6. I've amassed a portfolio approaching 300 million of assets, businesses and assets, and I'm close to where I think I was in 2016, right? I mean, we're just in a different, completely...
And we're talking about Hildreth.
Hildreth, yep.
So, yeah, talk to us about that. Walk the audience through Hildreth. Like, what was the thesis going in? How is it different than your previous venture?
Different because I want to try to actually get cash flow out of things. Yeah. So I bought a bunch of buildings by myself, and those were cash flowing.
Crazy, like crazy concept.
Shopping centers, right. Sure. Crazy, 4%, 5%, 6%. You know, I said, okay, can this be a syndicated platform, mm-hmm. right? Because I was good at I'm good at raising capital, right? It's also the hustling mentality. Most people don't want to do it. They hate it. Asking everyone for money, it's you get a reputation, but if you want to be in this business and be successful, you have to be able to raise.
You need access to a lot of cheap capital.
Right. You need access to a lot of.
If you have that, you can have expensive capital. It just makes it harder to do deals.
Right. You'll never make your promote.
Yeah.
You'll never make promote. And if you're doing deals just to do deals, you're also, that's going to fizzle out.
That's a fee business. And that, you know, tends to come back around after time.
Right. Right. So it's tough. It's a balancing act. So I said, can this be a syndicated platform? So I bought our first shopping center 2018 and, you know, I've since sold it and made my promote and, you know, I just kept going from there. I mean, I always had an eye on Manhattan, coming back to Manhattan. Then COVID happened, found this really, really cheap building. And then I found a partner to raise like $20 million in this one vehicle. And we bought a bunch of buildings throughout COVID. So the price of those was dirt cheap.
I was about to say, you probably timed that pretty well.
But now that the interest rates went up, yes, I could make something on each one, but not what the original exit plan was. So another, I wouldn't say pivoting, but now I just got to wait. I got to wait for my gratification, so to speak.
Your golden parachute.
For a small golden parachute, but
yeah,
same thing with in all the asset classes.
What in building Hildreth, like, is this a 7 day a week? You're kind of like you said in Brooklyn, but like, is it a nonstop focus for you or?
Oh, it's nonstop. I mean, it's 8 a.m. till 10 p.m. It's there is no stopping.
Personal life, like, is it all work right now? You have time for other things?
Of course. I mean, I like to travel. I have 2 kids. I have a wife. You know, it's like I make plenty of time for them, and I'm very fortunate where, you know, I get to spend a lot of time with them.
We get this question a lot from audience is some form of like, I want to start a business, but I'm afraid that part of that, it will kind of consume the rest of my life, which is just as if not more important, you know, marriage, kids, physical, mental health, those type of things. How do you kind of juggle all those things?
I mean, you got to take time for yourself.
How do you do that? Like do you meditate?
I did yoga this morning.
Okay.
You know, I try to do that once a week. I work out, even though I'm not looking like I work out right now.
You just
now.
Do yoga because it's like a 30-to-1 girl guy ratio, don't
right.
you?
Right. Do it one-on-one. I play a lot of tennis. I love tennis. Two, 3 days a week. Everyone knows me like out in the Hamptons. It's like the tennis guy, groups together, tournaments.
I'm gonna come hang with you and Jared in the summer in the Hamptons. Like he was selling me hard on like going out in the Hamptons. I've never gone out in the Hamptons, so
he doesn't really go. He plays tennis and poker.
Tennis and poker. I think it was like a poker party. Or
yes,
something.
You got to come once.
All right, I will.
Just for the entertainment.
You don't have to twist my arm.
Yeah,
I'll have a good time. So tennis. So that's and then kids on the weekend.
Yeah. I mean through these things you meet people and it all comes back to the business because part of my role in the company, right? Raising money. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be through social events.
Yeah. How do you like, is it, you know, kind of friends and family, country club, you know, individuals? Or have you taken a more institutional kind of one lumpy approach, like where it's one or two big chunky investors?
Or am I like co-GP types?
Yeah.
You know, people that will also come in and put money in and also help you raise the money.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly that. Because the institutions, like I mentioned before, want to put out. The check sizes are just insane.
They are, yeah. And it's especially in the deal size you play. Like, hey, we want to deploy 500 million and we want to do it in less than 10 deals. And you're like, okay, I'll do the math. Like, it's
not just possible.
It's hard to find that
right.
product.
Right. Like, one deal I'm close on right now, 24 million. It's going to be one of these co-GP
yeah.
types who has their family office already with committed capital, a family office I haven't met. Mm. And they'll get half the deal and half of everything.
So raising money, that's, you spend a lot of time there?
That's mostly acquisitions and raising money.
Do you
money.
Always raise money for your platform, or do you do third party?
Don't do third party. I wish I had the time.
I was going to say, if you're just so good at it, like if people pay you a fee.
It's very hard. Yeah. It's very hard for my own deals that I believe in, right? And I put my own money in every single deal.
Have you ever, I don't want to say I'm sure the answer is yes, but where you went out, you raised the capital, let's say you had to raise, you know, $5 million and you had 10 people with $500,000, and right as you get to the closing, two people, one person calls you like, hey, actually I'm out. And you're just like, are you kidding me?
Oh, happens all the time in all different iterations.
What goes through your head when that happens?
The bomb goes off, and then why am I putting this money that I'm fighting to get it back every day post-closing? I just had to do that bank retraded on a closing we closed yesterday. It's going to be untraded probably tomorrow or the next day. And the bank last minute said, we want a $250,000 escrow. Just no apparent reason. Just, we want it. I put in the money to save the deal, the investors. You know, we got all these types of investors, all different shapes and sizes. So now I'm going to fight tooth and nail to get that money back. It's just an annoyance.
Get it back from the lender?
From the lender, yeah. Huh. Yeah, yeah.
I say we have a big audience. You call that lender out, it'll put some pressure on them.
Yeah, I know. This is what's happening a lot lately. I've noticed that the banks are very, very tight, extremely tight. A lot of reporting requirements on current loans, tremendous amount. And they're being inflexible on most things.
Yeah.
So that is also a
we see it in our deals too.
It's an obstacle.
Multiple times you've achieved, been on the path or achieved success by definition in your job, your field, your industry, and you kind of touched on it earlier. Hey, you kind of got hit with something outside of your control. But where I want to kind of take the conversation is you have either been on the path or actually arrived at the destination of being successful in something. Like, what do you attribute that to?
I mean, it's just, you can just never give up.
So just like just a nonstop tenacity.
It's just a nonstop. Yeah. You don't have to be the smartest.
Okay.
You know, it's good to be smart.
Yeah.
Right. But
I mean, I don't know, but yeah.
You just got to be an animal at whatever you're doing, right? You're just be all in, right? Mm-hmm. You can't have one foot in, one foot out, like say, I'll do this later. I mean, you do that, and I'm guilty of it too. It never works out in your favor.
Okay.
Just try to do it now. You know, setting these goals, trying to accomplish goals. It's not easy to do.
What about, you know, you mentioned 100, 200 people that you've kind of had the opportunity to oversee, lead, manage, depending, you know, on your role and how you describe is, what has been a common reason why people have been successful in your organizations, in your businesses, that you've seen like, okay, this person's going to make it and here's why? And conversely, like what do you think has been a pretty common denominator of people who just did not do well?
From what I've seen, and a lot of people, and this is a tribute to what I've taught, you know, people go on and start their own companies or become successful in this, that, or the other. There's a certain way about them, a similar way of never giving up, being able to connect with people. I mean, I don't know if that's something that people are just born with and they grow into it over time, or they do it by like doing so many cold calls, like eventually, like, and all the people that
I think it's a learned skill. I was not natural at all. And I just had to make so many cold calls and meet so many people. I think you can learn how to be affable and likable.
100%. But these people that have been skilled did do the cold calling. Mm. The people that don't want to do the cold calling, they're not getting to a certain place.
Doesn't matter
place.
How skilled right. you are. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So anyone that I've seen, and I'm thinking back, guy that started making $300 a week was making $700,000 a year. When I saw you speak about people getting in early, staying late.
$300 a week, those are rookie numbers in this racket.
No, $300 a week. To making, $700,000. But making hundreds of calls, like handwriting letters all over the place. Like,
all of it, yeah.
Like 7 days.
Where did I speak?
The Rebney event with Michael Rutter.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
You know, just about like people getting in.
This is what it takes.
You know.
This is the way.
So
I didn't make the rules.
Right. So I see that. I see a guy that just left, started his own company. Same type of thing. Calling, being organized, data. Also had a brokerage background. First guy didn't, but he just, that's what I'm seeing a common trait. Another guy started hundreds of millions of dollar debt fund, knew him from Marcus. Just that's the way he is. Just call anybody at any time. Do the uncomfortable, right? Be uncomfortable. Do the uncomfortable.
Yeah, be uncomfortable long enough, you'll find yourself, from a life perspective, pretty comfortable in a good way, you know?
Right.
And what
call people that you don't know. You have to speak to people you don't know all the time.
I gotta make those coldies. What about, you know, it's kind of like the opposite is, are there other, you know, are there other characteristics that, you know, you feel like you run into pretty consistently of people who don't make it, quit, you got to terminate, you know, just, it's just not going to work out.
I mean, it comes down to a little bit of laziness, not willing to take the advice of people that have been there before. I think they know more than you, right? There's people that are young, and there's probably been a culture shift over the last, maybe since COVID, or the work at home, or the staying at home, or that people should get things given to them, or
it's still a big New York thing. I think it's still a thing everywhere, but like it's more New York. I think because again, this was the epicenter of the tragedy of COVID.
Yep.
But I do feel like that's coming back. Obviously,
it's coming back. There's a new. Well, now we're past that group. Now we're entering a new group. So the people that I'm trying to bring on now are like,
they never knew anybody.
They knew everybody. So if they're 24 now or 25, they didn't really know that because they were in college, I guess, or even high school, right? So they're.
It's not an entitlement.
Yeah, it's not an entitlement.
Or an expectation, I should say.
Right. So, you know, hopefully there'll be some sort of culture shift. And like I say, now I want to, you know, I want to bring on people that are like want to start their own business, so to speak.
How would you describe, you know, as an entrepreneur, how would you describe your leadership style now?
I mean, it's just got to be by example. I can't give the same amount of time in the office as I used to be able to give, the 5 days a week, 10 hours a day in the office, but I can lead by, all right, I'm always working on something, right? I'm always trying to push something forward. I'm always sending them something that I even find on the internet, right? That might be interesting. Like, just look at it, figure out what it is. Like, why not? And that's leadership. It's tough, but I kind of do it by example. I'm not necessarily the best communicator direct to people because I want results, right? I'm going to give you my time. I want at least the call is done, or at least a few opportunities a week. That's it to see.
When you're not leading and growing your business and obviously spending time or playing tennis, what else do you do? Is philanthropy? Are there other things that you focus your energy and time on?
There's always things to get involved in here and there, you know, attend events, because that's a way also leads back to business. You give out, you know, meet people at charity events and you give charity and give your time. Good things, I believe, will come back.
Yeah, circle. You get that good juju.
Yeah, I believe in that. And that's also helped.
What's the vision? What's the vision for Hildreth? Like, what's your blue sky scenario? You know, when you go to sleep at night and you kind of close your eyes, allow yourself to dream a little bit. Oof. You know, where do you see your professional life going?
I mean, we're building these micro businesses, I guess you could say, and eventually, you know, each one stands on its own feet, kind of like a smaller private equity firm. You know, we have these different buckets and keep growing these buckets, whether they lead to, you know, we're going to exit the shopping center bucket, right? Here's a whole bucket. Or we're going to enter or exit the Hamptons bucket. Or we're going to exit the Riverhead Opportunity Zone bucket one day. Hopefully that stuff is worth a lot more than what we paid, right? Because we're going through land entitlements, or we're going to exit the laundromat portfolio. That's what I think about. Every day I look into each one of these things, each asset. How do I improve it?
Liquidity events.
Yeah. Like, how do I monetize them, or how do we add to this bucket? I mean, that's what I do on a daily basis, right?
What if you have multiple successful liquidity events and you have, you know, from a capital and wealth standpoint, more than you ever need, like, do you see yourself slowing down, retiring? Are you always going to stay busy and work?
Oh, always stay busy.
Why do you think that is?
It's just the challenge.
It's,
Yeah, you know, it's
you know, learn something new. Learn something new. Like, I didn't know anything about laundromats, car washes, marinas. It's all taught. I didn't know anything about shopping centers in 2018 when I bought one.
Now you do.
Now I know. Now I know I love them, and I know why they don't sell very often.
And you know why you don't want to buy a shopping center with an on-site dry cleaner.
I've learned that lesson too.
Yeah,
I've lost a few dollars, not on my deposit, but in due diligence fees.
As a broker, I learned that a couple of times.
Painfully. Oh, it was a dry cleaner in 1940. I didn't tell you. No, you didn't tell me. Then I wouldn't have signed the deal. Yeah. Like
dumping percolate in the ground or something.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I'd say there's a segment of the population that might, from a judgment perspective, say, "Oh, like you're going to work your whole life. That's kind of sad." I've tried to explain, it's like, well, you know, it's kind of like if you find something you love to do, it's not work, but like it really falls into that. I enjoy this. I enjoy a challenge. I enjoy the competition. I enjoy overcoming obstacles and objections and finding success. It brings satisfaction and fulfillment. Like, would you say that's a fair statement and that applies to you?
Absolutely. And that's the reason why I keep doing what I do every single day and looking at new opportunities, whether it's a new business, whether it's a plumbing company, whether it's this, you got to keep open-minded, right? Mm-hmm. And look for those new challenges, because if you're not able to figure these things out, then you're not going to do much.
Yeah, that's true. Idle hands are the devil's workshop, you know? What do you see for the real estate market over the next year or two? I want to get a little prediction going.
I mean, I think it's
I want to say at like high level and then like New York.
High level, I mean, I think there's going to be an uptick in volume.
Amen.
There's got to be.
Can't get worse.
Can't get much worse. And everyone said, oh, the interest rates, this and that. But there's all these workouts happening behind mm-hmm. the scenes. And so I think that'll improve. And the whole New York, I mean, I think also depends on the product type. We'll see more. We'll see more movement. I mean, the stabilized stuff, I don't know who deals with that stuff or why, but
I mean, at some point the only thing that literally can happen is just prices resetting so much lower, and that often brings distress, and you've seen a lot of that in New York, to where even with the overbearing kind of draconian regulations, you can make money because the capitalism, you know, they need to be able to drive a profit. So, yeah.
I mean, I'm hoping for the best. Yeah. You know, you got to stay positive because, you know what, the last 2 years is pretty yeah, slow.
Certainly from pretty a volume slow. And deal side, but, you know, look, I'm in the business, obviously. I technically bet my money every day. We've already seen a material increase, you know, for us year over year, just candidly, but just to the pipeline leading into next year, like something big is happening, I think. It's not rates, like rates, you know, the kind of medium, long-term rates start to come down, then they kind of pop back up. But there just seems to be an optimism. I don't know if it's, you know, not politics. It's like just the election and the election being over is a distraction.
That was an excuse.
Yeah, that's what it
distracts. That was a 3-6 month excuse.
Distraction's gone. If rates can, you know, just frankly not go up, but just, you know, candidly float down, both short-term rates with Fed funds or, you know, SOFR, but even medium long terms, you know, kind of looking at 5 and 10 year treasuries, those can float down. Like, you know, cap rates have moved a lot, yields have moved a lot up, and value has come down in a lot of product types. And so that gap that you kind of start every deal at between a buyer and a seller on average, it just, as that shrinks, hopefully, and it already has started, but as it continues to, that should lead to an increase in deals. So hopefully we both see continuing increased activity accelerate us getting to where we want to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, David, you've worn a lot of hats, and it's really kind of been interesting to see how, you know, you've almost had to pivot multiple times, and you just kind of have this like, it is what it is. I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to make it work. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, you got to, because if I just stuck doing my one little micro thing, I don't know. I don't like to sit on my hands. Some people can afford to and do that. It's just not my way. I want to, like I said, want to be busy. I want to take on challenges. I want to challenge myself. I want to challenge others. And, you know, I'm here to work. I'm not here to just sit and not try to get to the next level.
Well, I know you're busy today. I hope we're busier even tomorrow, metaphorically, as the market continues to kind of come out of a tough period, you know, as rates, again, hopefully stabilize, come down. You know, blue skies ahead, God willing. Can't thank you enough for coming on. I really appreciate it. It's, you know, a lot of times when I interview guests, they kind of have, you know, it's just like, not in a bad way, just they did one thing and they just did it a long period of time. I feel like you've already in a, you know, in a short period of time, pivoted multiple times. And really the lesson, you know, for the audience is, I'll talk about myself. Like, you kind of have this like vision for your life, this track, and this is what I'm going to do. And life doesn't always cooperate, right? The market doesn't always cooperate. And you just naturally had ability, developed the ability to just like shift quick and just stay malleable and just stay moving forward. And I think that's to be admired. And obviously it's led you to tremendous success. So congratulations.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on. And then I look forward to hanging out in the Hamptons with you and Jerry. We'll have a good time.
Whenever you want.
All right, my man. Thank you.
Thank you.